Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Jack Kerouac, the influential beat writer, really writing a lot in the 1950s, who wrote the legendary book On the Road. Well, today we're going to be in conversation about the life of Jack Kerouac and a whole lot more. My guest is Gerald Nicosia. Gerald Nicosia is the author of a number of books, including books about Jack Kerouac, including Memory Babe, a critical biography of Jack Kerouac, as well as other books on the Beats and the 1960s. His latest book is called Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. Gerald Nicosia, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you back to our radio station.
It's great to be back.
Interesting to me, as we mark the 50th, it'll be October 21st.
That's right.
It'll be the 50th anniversary of the death of Jack Kerouac. And as I was looking at his biography, he died at the age of 47.
Yes.
I am now at the age of 47. Of course, spent my youth reading many of Jack Kerouac's books, Dharma Bones, On the Road, obviously. But what struck me about seeing his age of dying at 47 is that if you look at the late photos of him or the late interviews with him, he looked a lot older than 47.
Yeah, well, he was a very far-gone alcoholic, you know. And I mean, he was essentially killing himself, and he even told people that, because he was a very unhappy man, especially in the later part of his life. And he was also a very devout Catholic. He became a Buddhist for a few years, and then at the end of his life went back to Catholicism, and he told people, I can't commit suicide because it's a mortal sin, like shooting himself. He said, but I can take the slow way out. Now, this is kind of funny. He thought it was, you know, legitimate as a Catholic, as long as he drinks himself to death. But he was literally drinking himself to death. And, you know, a quart of alcohol, quart of whiskey, about 20 beers a day. People, you know, followed him on that, wrote it down. That's what he was drinking. And so he was bloated. His liver was you know, huge. His stomach protruded. He was, the end of his life was very, very sad. And he was, as a young man, a very beautiful, handsome, athletic football player, star running back for Columbia University. And at the end of his life, well, he, as he said, he had trouble getting out of his chair because of, you know, his big bloated stomach.
I mean, I think most people are familiar now with Jack Kerouac. They may not be familiar that he was a star football player at Columbia.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I have no idea. I know that the younger people love Kerouac. I mean, it's funny because On the Road was published in 1957. I'm of the 10-year later generation. I was, you know, one of the hippie generation. I graduated high school in 1967. My generation was, of course, the hippies reading Kerouac like crazy. But then in the 70s, I saw it again. And then in the 80s, even with the punks, were reading Kerouac, Burroughs and Kerouac. The 90s, again, there was a lot of his records were published, his recordings. There was a big event in Hollywood where 1,000 young people came out to celebrate the release of Rhino Records, of his recordings. But every succeeding decade, I see new generations reading Kerouac. So the appeal goes on. I mean, obviously, I think my generation being closer to that maybe knew that he was a football player. I did. But, you know, now there's a whole new generation of 18-year-olds reading Kerouac, and they're obviously finding something in him that's really attractive. But whether they know the early biography of him, you know, the poor working-class kid, French-Canadian kid coming out of Lowell, Milltown. The only way he got to Columbia was on a football scholarship because his family had no money at all. I'm not sure how much of the biography, you know, is something people pick up today.
Do you feel as though later in life Jack Kerouac changed? And I say this again because I think about the late interviews I've seen, and I see an kind of a grumpy, maybe even a conservative man. Would that be accurate?
Well, I don't know that he changed that much. I mean, he was a very complicated man. In some ways, he was kind of schizophrenic because he was torn all of his life. There's a very early journal entry, which I read of his, which was amazing because he was saying, you know, I want to follow the Catholic religion. I want to follow the laws of the Catholic Church, but I also want to experience life. I also want to go out. I can't be a writer unless I go out and experience all of life, all the things you can do, all the people. And there was this conflict because he realized that if he just, you know, stayed home and prayed every day and was a good Catholic, he couldn't go out and do all these things. He wanted both. And he never reconciled it. I think that had a lot to do with the anguish that he felt, because, you know, he could never be the really, his brother was supposedly a saint. His brother died at the age of 10, rheumatic fever, and the nuns in the Catholic Church in Lowell said that this little boy, Gerard, was a saint. And his mother, Jack's mother, all his life said, you need to live up to Gerard. Your brother, had he lived, would have been a saint. There was a part of Kerouac that wanted to be the saint, but then the other part wanted to go out and experience life. And that set up a huge conflict in him.
Huh. You mentioned Lowell. You're speaking of Lowell, Massachusetts, where he grew up.
Working class town, mill town, one of the original mill towns in America. Then became depressed because the mills moved out. The union labor got too expensive. The mills went down to the Carolinas. And so a lot of these people that had been poor working class people were then poor, even poorer out of work people. Mm. So it was a hard place to grow up. And sports was one of the few ways out.
Again, I think most people are familiar now with Jack Kerouac for the very dynamic that you mentioned, considering that each generation since has found interest in his and other beatnik writings. Is there a mythology around the life of Jack Kerouac, do you think?
Oh, there's a huge mythology, and it's so hard to... And Kerouac helped to create it himself. I mean, in some ways, he created this mythology of this handsome, dynamic, hobo wanderer, vagabond writer. He played into it a lot, but it's created this mythology where people think, well, here was Kerouac, this wild man who just went out and did anything in life, just bit off big chunks of life, and where you really had a very serious, philosophical, religious person who did pray a lot, who was always reading all kinds of religious texts, trying to find... He, at one point, in an interview in New York, he said, they asked him, what do you really want? And he said, I want to see God's face. So you have, you know, a lot of people, they see Kerouac as this wild, charismatic hobo figure, whatever you want to say, a rebel, iconoclast. But then there was this other Kerouac that a lot of people don't know, who was this serious searcher, the serious religious searcher for life. And I'm not sure that, I think the one is much more colorful. So, and the marketing, there's been, of course, a lot of marketing of his products with his name on it. And they use that image of the romantic vagabond. The other image is not so marketable, you know, of the quiet religious seeker. So I think people know that first one a lot better. And sometimes it's a surprise to them to find out that he really had this very quiet, deep philosophical side.
Did he find a way to combine Buddhism, which he would go to, with Catholicism? And didn't you find some documents concerning this, some writings concerning this?
Well, and one of the things my book talks about is, I talk about really all the things that have happened since he died. And one of the good things was the publishing of a lot of his hidden writings, his posthumous writings. And of course, they published a book called Some of the Dharma, S-O-M-E, Some of the Dharma, which was an attempt by him. It was published, I don't know, 2006, quite a few years after he died. But he was an attempt where he was trying to reconcile Catholicism and Buddhism. And I mean, there were a lot of common points for him because, you know, he believed greatly in compassion. He had a tremendous heart for the poor and the suffering. That's one of the things I think that makes his writing so attractive to so many people. If you're a loser, or so-called a loser, you know, by society, you're an outsider, you're down and out. The compassion was the reconciling point, because Buddhism obviously teaches compassion toward all living things. In fact, Kerouac told someone that he thought Buddhism was superior to Catholicism on that point, because he said, Catholicism, you're just being compassionate toward fellow Christians, basically. But he said, Buddhism, you're being compassionate toward every living thing, even a blade of grass. So it was that the even greater compassion in Buddhism that attracted him. But that was one of the main things that he saw. And also the unreality of the world. I mean, basically, Christianity teaches that, you know, the things of this world pass away. Rust and, what is the quote, thieves break through and steal. And Buddhism also teaches that, the things we see here are passing. They're transient. They're going away. The one big difference, and I talked to Gary Snyder about this, because I was asking Gary at one point, well, and Gary, of course, I guess is probably the greatest living American Buddhist. I mean, here's a guy who's studied everything, even was a monk in Japan for 3 years. I said, was Kerouac really, truly a Buddhist? And he said, well, the one thing Kerouac could not let go of was a belief in a personal God. He said, Snyder said, if you are a true Buddhist, something called the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the diamond sword, it cuts through all the beliefs, even the belief in a God, in a personal creator. You have to throw that out the door. And he said, Kerouac couldn't do that. Kerouac was deeply attached to a personal God. And it's in many of his writings where he's praying to God and talking to God. So that was the one place where he could never completely let go.
Did Kerouac always have a relationship to Buddhism, or did he drop it later in life?
I think it was a very brief period. I mean, he started reading the Buddhist Sutras in probably 53. He got very deeply into it for a few years. He read a whole lot, thousands of pages, and tried to practice it for a few years, but probably by 58 or 59, he just felt that it wasn't working for him, and that basically he began to work his way back toward the Catholic Church.
Gerald Nicosia, tell me about your own odyssey with Jack Kerouac. This goes back. I mean, you didn't know him.
No.
But your writing about him goes back to what, 1979?
Well, I was writing about him even before 79. I mean, I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois in Chicago in 71, 72, 73. And Kerouac was not taught in any... I was getting a graduate degree in American literature, and Kerouac was not taught in any courses. It's one of the things I talk about in the new book as well, is that if you go back to the early 70s, you could hunt far and wide to find a course in Jack Kerouac or any of the beat writers. I was a teaching assistant at the University of Illinois, and I shared an office with kind of a hip kid from Harvard who kept razzing me that I hadn't read Kerouac. Who are you? You haven't read Kerouac. You're nothing. So I got mad one day. I thought, I'm going to read Kerouac, find out what this is all about. This was 1972, and at that point, most of his books were out of print. On the Road and Dharma Bums were basically the two books that were still in print, and so I figured On the Road was the really famous one. I'll read the other one. And I picked up the Dharma Bums, and reading that book in 1972 really changed my life. It was a profound experience. And in some ways, I was prepared for that because my father was a Sicilian immigrant, self-taught. His father was killed when he was young. He was working on the streets of Chicago when he was 10 years old. But he read and read and read. And one of the things my father always had read a lot of was Jack London. The socialism, the concern for the poor. And when I was a kid, my father used to read to me from Jack London, The Iron Heel, a great book about the oppression of the poor by the wealthy. And so I had all of this in me. And as I'm reading the Dharma Bums, I'm thinking, wow, this is like Jack London. Here's a guy who's really, he's not writing about the upper middle classes like, the books they were teaching me in college, Updike and Philip Roth and all of these people, writing about very well-off people. Saul Bellow, he's writing about the hobos and the junkies and the whores and the petty thieves on Times Square, the homeless. He's writing about the real down and out in America, and he's not writing about them in a sociological way, which is the only way that most people were looking at them. He was writing about them with his big heart for, I care about these people. I want them to be happy. I want them to have a better life. And so it struck this chord in me that this was Jack London for my own era. And so I started asking my professors, why is no one teaching Kerouac? And they would have these terrible put-downs for him. 1972, he's not even a writer. He's a vagabond, a leader of beatniks. One guy said he's a vortex. I said, what do you mean? Well, vortex, it's empty in the middle, but it draws other people in. Kerouac was valuable because he drew other people in, but there wasn't really anything there. And it really enraged me. And that's why I said, at some point, if I ever get a chance, I'm going to write a biography of this guy that shows these professors why he's a great writer. They don't seem to get it, And in 1977, I met a guy in Chicago who was starting an independent magazine. He had a little bit of money from his father. He said, what project would you like to do? I said, I'd like to write a biography of Jack Kerouac. Can we serialize it in your magazine? And he said, yeah. He was kind of a crazy radical guy, Carl Mackey. He lives in the Bay Area now. And he said, sure, serialize it in my magazine. Well, the magazine never happened. His father cut off the money, but I had a check for my first trip. I had enough money to get to New York. And met Stanley Twardowicz, who was this artist on Long Island who Kerouac used to come to his studio every day. Kerouac's pants and jacket were still hanging on the wall of this guy's studio. And I started getting all this fabulous material that nobody knew about. And he introduced, and Kerouac used to hang out with the fishermen, the clammers in Northport, Long Island. And I'm meeting all these clammers who had great stories about drinking with Jack. And I'm thinking, nobody's ever tapped this material. And so when Carl said, well, sorry, but there's no more money, my father just cut it off. I said, well, damn it, I'm going to keep going. And I did. I was hitchhiking and sleeping on people's floors. And I had one thing I had was a really good Sony tape recorder. And I took it with me all over the country and all over Canada, too. I ended up taping interviews with 300 people.
300 people who knew Jack Kerouac?
Yeah.
Wow. And that would be your biography on Jack.
That was the research that went into Memory Babe, yes.
Yeah. What, was it always controversial? Maybe not today, but before and even during his time as seeing Jack Kerouac as a serious literary figure?
Oh, extremely so. I mean, when my biography was published in 1983, Memory Babe was published by Grove Press. I went into several other editions, including University of California Press for a while. But when it was published, a lot of the reviews were most of the reviews were very, very positive. I mean, I got front cover reviews in the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune and Washington Post. But the reviews were all basically, this is an incredibly researched book. Mr. Nicosia has discovered every detail of Kerouac's life. But then they would usually add parenthetically, but his views about Kerouac as being the equivalent of Proust and Joyce and Dostoevsky are really kind of far off. He's a little crazy about it. I mean, it was, you know, hilarious in a way, because now, of course, Kerouac is rated with all these great writers. But at that time, they thought, you know, Mr. Nicosia, he's a great researcher and all that, but his ideas about Kerouac as a great writer, that's kind of wacky. So it's taken a while to get there.
Yeah, and why is it? Because, as you were talking about earlier, Jack Kerouac talked about, you know, people who are on, you know, strung out and in the slums and these things. Is that why? Or is there something more about his writing that was different?
Well, I mean, certainly the fact that he used a jazz style, he tried to write like bebop jazz, long flowing sentences, improvisation.
Charlie Parker was like a god.
Yeah, he was trying to turn prose into Charlie, transform Charlie Parker's solos into prose. So that definitely was difficult, and a lot of academics don't quite get writing like jazz. But I think that the other thing that you said had a lot to do with it. I mean, it wasn't just that he was writing about hobos and down and out people, but he was writing about them as if they were people of great worth, people of great dignity, that each person, whether they were a hooker on Times Square, this person had human dignity and had to be respected and loved. And of course, when the book came out, this was the 1950s, the height of American conservatism. America was just barely past McCarthyism, and there was still a tremendous amount of judgmentalism. You had to dress the right way and have the right sort of job, and women still had to be kept in their place, and minorities still had to be kept in their place. So here's Kerouac basically saying every human being, whatever his race, whatever his sexual orientation, whatever his sexual practices, whatever his income or lack of income, has to be treated with equal dignity. That's always been a revolutionary thing, I think.
Gerald Nicosia is our guest, and you're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we are in conversation about Jack Kerouac here on the 50th anniversary of his death. He died on October 1st, 21st, 1969. Gerald Nicosia is the author of a number of books, including books on Jack Kerouac. His latest is called Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. Let's start to dive more into your latest book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. Talk to me about the transformation of Jack Kerouac after his death, from being this person who is not considered such a literary figure into one being considered a literary figure. I mean, there's really a campaign behind that, isn't there?
I don't know if I'd say campaign so much, but a lot of the recognition started outside of the United States. One of the things you have to understand is that his books were always in print in England and France and other country, a lot of other countries. When I wanted to get his books and I couldn't buy, after I found that I really loved this writer in 1972 and I couldn't buy most of his books anywhere, I started ordering them from England. And they were shipping them to me from England. One of the first conferences about Kerouac was in Plymouth, England, which I went to in 1987. And in Quebec City, there was a major international conference on Kerouac in 1988. So there was a lot of stuff going on where scholars in other countries were speaking about the importance of Kerouac. And I think in some ways that helped to open the doors for people here to look at his importance. And you also had a younger generation in Lowell that pushed for a memorial. I mean, there's a very important area of Lowell, a kind of Kerouac Park, where there's these big big granite pillars with his words engraved on them. Well, that was a big fight, too, because initially the people in Lowell, a lot of the older generation, regarded Kerouac as a disgrace. They said he drank, he was drunk and he stank like a goat. And they said, we're not going to have a memorial to this guy, a marker. But there was a younger generation that had fought the Lowell City Council for several years that finally made that happen. 1988, they dedicated this memorial park with the writings on marble to Kerouac. So there was coming from different directions. A younger generation was pushing for it. People that were now my age were starting to get into teaching positions, more positions of authority, where they had some influence. And you had, again, so much coming from outside the country, people saying in other countries, this is a great American writer. The American academia had to start to pay attention to him. And also there was the commercial value, I guess, aided it too, because people discovered, hey, there's all these out-of-print Kerouac books. There's unpublished Kerouac books. Hey, there's all these recordings. I mean, Rhino Records down in Los Angeles, they realized that Kerouac had made several records, and he was a really great reader. Because he was into jazz, he had a great sense of performance. And they said, well, we should reissue these recordings. And when Rhino Records reissued all those recordings, that was a big event. So people capitalizing on the commercial value, that all contributed to it. So it is amazing to me. I think the whole punks, thing that happened in the 70s and 80s, they picked up Kerouac as a forebear. A lot of things converged, but what, started out as the little streams started gathering together, and pretty soon you had a mighty river. It amazes me today when I look at how many books are, I can't even keep up with all the books being written on the beats in Kerouac. I mean, I have shelves and shelves of them now. And when I started out, there was Ann Charter's book on Kerouac. That was all there was when I started.
And now I think everyone has, the Viking Reader?
The Viking Kerouac. Kerouac. I mean, and they've, published a lot of his unpublished books. I talk about that in my new book. And to me, there's some question about whether you should even do that, because obviously they're published because they make a lot of money, but they go into 20 languages instantly. But a lot of these things that are being published now are his juvenilia. They're books he wrote when he was 16 or 17 or 18, and they're not really that good, and they don't really add a lot to his reputation. So there's almost been oversaturation in a way.
Because it sells.
Because it sells, yeah.
And it's all about the sales in the publishing world?
A lot of it is. A lot of it is. And, one of the things, I'd like to mention here, because in my book I talk a lot about his real family, and that was his daughter, Jan, and then his sister had a son, Paul Blake Jr. That was Kerouac's nephew, who was very close to Jack. Jack wrote about him in several of his books. He called him Little Paul and Lil Luke. But his daughter and his nephew got nothing. There was a forged will that gave the Sampas family his entire estate.
Who was the Sampas family?
Jack Kerouac married a woman named Stella Sampas 3 years before he died, specifically because his mother had a stroke. And the only real woman in Jack Kerouac's life was his mother. I mean, there's a whole dark side of Kerouac, which again is something that I'm writing about here, that a lot of people don't want to talk about because it goes against this image of the happy, dynamic, vagabond roamer of the country. But, the only woman that he really had any major attachment to was his mother. And he was really, in some ways, controlled by his mother. And she would even tell him when he'd go out with a new girlfriend, I don't like that girlfriend, get rid of her. He'd drop a girlfriend because his mother told him not to have it. And so when she had a stroke, his mother had a stroke, in 1966, this is 3 years before Jack died, his mother told him, you can't put me, she was paralyzed, she said, I'm not going into a nursing home, you have to take care of me, Jackie. And here's the king of the beats, I mean, the guy that goes out for 5 nights in a row on binges, and he's like, how am I going to take care of a paralyzed mother? So he married an older woman from Lowell, Stella Sampas, you know, woman, never been married. She was an older sister of his boyhood friend, Sammy Sampas, who was an important person in his life, to take care of his mother. And the marriage wasn't working, and he was trying to divorce her when he died, but he didn't live long enough, and he was still married at the end. But he left everything to his mother. And the Sampas family, it was established in court in Florida, forged her will and left everything to themselves, to the Sampases. But because of a law, which is essentially was a statute of limitations, it's a complicated law, I won't go into it here, but essentially Jan Kerouac, Jack's daughter, discovered it too late. And even though it was, and she died before it was even proven, but, and the nephew is still, well, the left nephew died in December. Jack's nephew has a big family, the Blakes, that still live in one trailer in Arizona, very, very poor. But they didn't get anything because the statute of limitations essentially said, you proved this too late. And so I write about Jan, and she was dying of kidney failure for the last 5 years of her life, and she was trying to finish her third novel. Very fine novelist, and she has
his daughter.
His daughter, Jan Kerouac, Baby Driver, Train Song, and she was trying to finish a book called Parrot Fever when she died. And her books have been kept out of print since she died, and part of that is because of the estate issues that she was trying to disprove the Sampas's right to that estate, and so there's been a lot of pressure. Again, I won't go into details, but pressure to keep her work out of print. And she was a fine writer and struggled greatly to finish that third book when she was on kidney dialysis four times a day fighting to prove her legal right to the estate when she was dying on kidney dialysis. And then there's the nephew's family, and he died in December. And when his last words were to his son, who's a friend of mine, Paul Blake III. They're all Paul Blake, 1, 2, and 3. And Paul Blake Jr., who died in December, told his son, he said, I should have had a better life. And he should have.
I mean, I suspect in the last 30 years, the writings and works of Jack Kerouac have earned millions of dollars.
Well, yeah, the estate's been conservatively evaluated at $30 million. I mean, just the manuscript of On the Road sold for $2.5 million to Jim Irsay, the owner of the Colts, the Indianapolis Colts. But that was one manuscript. And of course, all of the, Jack wrote 9 of his books on these roll manuscripts. He would fast typer. He would feed long 100-foot rolls of paper into the typewriter.
So not individual pieces of paper?
No. Well, the first one, he took 20-foot strips of tracing paper and taped them together. After that, he thought, this is too hard, and he got UPI teletype rolls and just fed the teletype rolls. And so 9 of his key manuscripts from his archive are on those long rolls of paper, and we don't have access to any
of
them.
Old scrolls. Almost.
But they were all sold off because of the family that got this material through the forged will, sold them all off into private hands because they were getting great amounts of money, $2.5 million from Jim Mercer. And we don't know where they are. And this really hinders Kerouac studies. And this,
we don't know where these scrolls are?
No, we don't. The only one we know is Jim Mercer because he has been at least kind enough that he sends it around the country. You may have seen it. It's in a glass case and you can't really study it. You can't really make notes on it, but you can see it. And he puts it at universities in a glass case. But the other 8 roll manuscripts, and there's the Dharma Bums, and there's Desolation Angels, and there's Vanity of Duluaz, Big Sur. There were 9 that I traced that were on rolls of paper. We don't even know where those rolls of paper are. And it really hinders Kerouac's scholarship to have had, and all of his books were sold off, which is another thing that I lament in my book. Kerouac had a large library, and he annotated it. He would write, as I do in my books, he would write in the margins. And one of the first things that John Sampas, who's dead now also, one of the first things John Sampas sold off were Kerouac's own books. And so we can't look at those books and see, what did he write in the margin of Dostoevsky? What did he write in the margin of Celine, these authors that influenced him? So it's, you know, the situation has really, really hindered Kerouac's scholarship.
I mean,
a great
somebody
deal.
Who spent a lifetime writing about Jack Kerouac, I'm sure you'd like to see these.
Well, I would, and a lot of other scholars would too. Because, you know, what we're getting now finally is some attempt to evaluate Kerouac as a great writer and look at his methodology and look at his tone and look at his style and look at his mechanics of his writing, the way we've done with Joyce and Hemingway and other great writers. For too long, there's just been looking at Kerouac as, isn't he a great, colorful, vagabond figure? But it's really high time that we start, you know, really looking at the mechanics. How did he achieve all these great effects in his writing? And that's what's so difficult now. And also, there's been a great deal of control by the Sampas family in terms of what people write, that they will not give permissions if they don't like the interpretation. And this really hinders Kerouac's scholarship. Writers, scholars should be free to write whatever they want, in my view. They shouldn't have to, like, get the permission of the estate to say something about Jack Kerouac's writing.
Is that how it is now?
That's how it is now, yes. And that's one of the things I'm writing this book to try to encourage the people that now control his estate to open things up and let the scholarship really be free. And because that's what we need. We need to really start to look at Kerouac as a writer, not just as a figure, you know.
And you're very much a part of this story. You tried many times while she was still alive to talk to Stella.
Well, Stella would not talk to anyone, and I think now we understand why. I remember when I first started writing my book, and I was obviously trying to interview everybody that I could find, 300 people, and one of the people who helped me, I'd like to mention, is Larry Lee. He had written a book called Jack's Book with Barry Gifford, an oral biography of Jack Kerouac. Very important early book. Really good, absolutely still worth reading. Jack's Book by Larry Lee and Barry Gifford. Larry died young of AIDS. He was one of the first casualties of AIDS in this Bay Area. I don't forget if it was 1989, 1990 that he died. But he was a very, very kind guy. And Larry gave me a lot of places to go when I was from kid from the Midwest. Who do I interview? And Larry Lee was one of the people who said, here's some addresses, here's some names. And so at one point I said to Larry, well, you know, I want to interview Stella, of course. And he said, nope, she won't talk to anybody. And I said, why? And he didn't know. And I remember talking to her family, and they said, well, she wants to protect Jack. That's why she won't give out any interviews. She would hang up, slam down the phone if you would call her, or chase you away from her door if you showed up at
it. Which you did.
Well, I didn't show up because I was stalking her. I had now gotten an award for the manuscript from the National Society of Arts and Letters, something called the Distinguished Young Writer Award, and they were having a convention down in Clearwater, and I was invited to speak at the banquet because my book, Memory Bay, was just about to be published. They had given me an award and a grant for it. And Stella lived nearby in St. Petersburg, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to invite her. And she wouldn't talk on the phone, so I drove to her door with my mother to invite her. We were going to the banquet in Clearwater that night, and her sister called her to the door, and Stella saw me, and she starts screaming, go away, go away, go away. And I think now, you know, we do understand, because she was involved in a forgery, which nobody knew at that time. And because the records show that before Gabrielle Kerouac, Jack's mother, died, Stella was open. She invited people to the house. She talked with anybody who came. I mean, there's a long record of this. She met Barry Gifford back in early 73 and invited him in. But after the death of Gabrielle, Stella wouldn't talk to anyone. And now that we know that there was, you know, she was involved in a forgery, well, it kind of makes sense that she was probably scared and didn't want to start unearthing things with journalists or biographers.
So what happened, Jerry? Are there two wills, one that's forged and one that was real?
No.
That Jack Kerouac left everything to his mom?
Well, no, the one he left to his mom was a real will. And he did, and his mother outlived him. You see, Jack died in 69. His mother didn't die till 1973. So, but when his mother died, a will was forged, and filed, which left everything to the Sampas family.
So was that a will that was forged in the name of his mother, not Jack Kerouac?
Yeah. It was Jack Kerouac's mother's will, and they misspelled Kerouac on that. Well, that's why Jan didn't see, nobody saw that will until 1994. It was finally brought out, and Jan said, my grandmother's name is misspelled. But the reason that the Sampas family still keeps things is that the third will is Stella's will, because when Stella Kerouac, Jack's widow, died in 1990, she still was in possession of all of this material. Nobody even knew there was a forgery. And when she died, she left everything, including Jack's papers and copyrights, to her brothers and sisters. Now, that is a totally legitimate will. Nobody's saying Stella's will was forged. It was a legal will. That's the will that has now proved the stumbling block for Kerouac's family, because, again, what we were saying before, Florida law allows you to keep anything you inherit. Anything could be stolen property as long as no one complains within 2 years. Well, Stella left everything to her family in 1990. Jan didn't see the forged will till 1994, 4 years later. So by Florida law, those brothers and sisters can keep everything they inherited, even though it was ruled and upheld on appeal. It's stolen property. It's a strange situation, a very strange situation, and a very sad situation for the family of the Blakes, who are really good people in Arizona, and who would like to have a hand in control, not controlling, but determining what happens to Jack's papers and his image. You know, that they feel that there's been too much of a commercialization. His image is on, they were selling Volvos and Banana Republic leather jackets, and the family that
is that's what happening. Has there been a commercialization? People that have controlled this state
They use Jack's image for Kerouac wears khakis. I mean, they've sold all kinds of things through that, and his real family feels like they wish that they had some say at this point. And they are his family. That's his Jack's sister, Jack Kerouac's sister's family, and they'd have no say at all. So this is all in my new book, if you want to read about it.
Gerald Nicosia is our guest. He is the author of the book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. This is the 50th anniversary this year of the death of Jack Kerouac. So the Sampas family, who still controls the Kerouac estate.
Yes, John Sampas died. When Stella died, seven or eight brothers and sisters inherited the material, but they chose the youngest bachelor brother, John Sampas, to be the executor, the guy who would determine who, you know, what do we sell, what rights do we market. He died about a year ago, and at that point, his nephew, Jim Sampas, and his adopted son, John Shen Sampas, became the executors. So they are the people now who are determining things.
Why won't they open the records up to allow people like yourself to go through them?
I don't understand the control that is exercised. I mean, partly I think there is...
Is it that you go through it, then write your own book about it, and now they're not going to capitalize on that?
I think they're worried about bad things being said about their family because, you know, Jack's marriage to Stella was very unhappy. Let's say it outright, it's a stupid thing to marry somebody to take care of your mother. I mean, it just is. It's not a good reason to get married. And, you know, within weeks after that marriage, Jack realized this wasn't working. Stella didn't understand him at all. She was a small-town Greek girl. Jackie, you need to stay at home and write every night. You know, he says, this isn't how I work. I go out on binges for 2 weeks, and then I come home and write. And so, you know, she would yell at him, and she'd call her brothers to come and get him when he was out in the bars and drag him home. And he said, this isn't working. And he was trying to divorce her, but he didn't live long enough for that divorce to happen. But those 3 years that he was married to were very unhappy years. He was constantly fighting with her family. They were trying to keep him home. They even hid his clothes for a while, and he used to go out in his pajamas. So I think that in some sense, the Sampas family doesn't want a lot of that stuff to be exposed. But I think they're overcompensating. I mean, they're not just controlling the image of Jack in the last 3 years. They're controlling now just about everything that's written about them. They have to have permission. They have to agree with what you've written before they give you permission to publish anything that where you're using his materials.
So if you quote him, on the road, I mean, there's not even like
there's fair usage, of course, and you can get around that. But there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been published, which is some of it has ended up in the libraries. Unfortunately, not the nine roll manuscripts, which are the most important. But at one point, John Sampas did sell a lot of his notebooks to the New York Public Library, which was an important thing. And I give them credit where credit is due. I'm really glad those notebooks are in the New York Public Library because there's a lot of really great personal stuff that we didn't know about Kerouac in those notebooks. But the problem is if you want to use those notebooks, you have to get permission from the Sampases to see them. If you want to quote from anything in those notebooks, fair use doesn't cover unpublished material. You have to go to them for permission. And they have, I know personally that they've stopped a lot of people from publishing things because they didn't agree with what was being written.
Well, what are we talking about that's out there that we haven't been able to read yet because it's unpublished?
Well, there's lots and lots of notebooks. Jack Kerouac kept journals all of his life. I mean, there's thousands of pages of journals. Everywhere he went, he had these little breast pocket notebooks. And he would write down, if he was here with you, Mitch, he would be, probably even if he was talking to you, he'd be writing in that notebook, you know, he's got a green shirt on. He was that meticulous. There's one lamp in the room. So, I mean, there's all these journals and breast pocket notebooks. And of course, his correspondence, which a lot of it is still unpublished. Any of that material, which is rich in biographical, and some of it even in data about how he wrote, talking about the mechanics of his writing, that's stuff I think we should all be free. Me, anybody else who's a scholar, historian, critic, academic, to write about whatever we like. We've used that material. Well, I think Kerouac was stupid here. You should have the right to say that, right? I mean, that is how scholarship progresses. Maybe somebody says the wrong thing, somebody else says the right thing, but you have to let everybody give their opinions and use that material. So they have not really, they have not benefited Kerouac by this kind of close control over what is being written about him.
I can't get out of my mind. You talked about how he wrote, he has 9 manuscripts on paper rolls.
Well, he was a fast typist. You see, he could type 110 words a minute. In fact, for him, he was frustrated because he liked to get into this flow, you know, the Charlie Parker, the jazz flow. Remember, Parker could
go on for
a long
binge minute. Writing a little.
Well, because he was imitating those jazz guys that would blow a Coltrane, blow these long solos, and he would be frustrated because he would have to change the paper in the typewriter every 11 inches, and that would break his flow. And he kept thinking, this was why he finally got to this thing of taping these sheets together, and later the UPI teletype rolls. You don't have to change the sheets. You can just keep typing, typing, typing. And, of course, everybody says, well, if he lived today, he wouldn't have any problem. He'd just work on a computer. You don't have to change the sheets in a computer. But he didn't have computers when he was around.
I can't help but also just think of ancient scrolls. I mean, that's how books used to be out there. You know, if you went in.
Well, you know, I have one pet peeve, which I also mentioned in this book, that when they eventually published the whole, the original roll edition of On the Road as it was written, which is quite different than what was eventually edited by Viking Penguin. Kerouac did make changes, for the record. They called it, to market it, they called it the scroll edition of On the Road. Kerouac never used that word scroll. It's kind of a pretentious word. I mean, he was the least pretentious. He was a working class guy who liked sports bars and working class people. He always called it the roll manuscript. And people said, the roll manuscript? And he'd say, yes, it's like the highway unrolling in front of your tire, the white line of the highway unrolling as you're driving at night in your headlights on a lonely, narrow road. And I always loved that image of the writing unrolling like this long highway in front of your tires. But when they marketed it, they marketed it as a scroll edition, and that word has stuck. But it's too pretentious. Kerouac would never, I mean, he wouldn't have compared his work to the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was great marketing propaganda. It got Jim Irsay to pay $2.5 million for the scroll. But for Kerouac, it was the roll, and it was the writing that was like the highway unrolling in front of your headlight.
Can you tell me more about the dark side that you mentioned concerning Jack Kerouac that we don't know as much about, or at least in popular media?
Well, we don't know a lot about it. Again, this is part of the censorship that has been practiced on Kerouac's estate. Kerouac has become a marketable property, and with a marketable property, you want to highlight something and show the good sides. If you're selling a house, you have the house cleaned up, right, and painted before you sell it. You don't want to show people the cracks in the wall or the cracks in the plumbing. And it's kind of the same thing with the way Kerouac has been handled as a marketable property. They want to highlight the happy, romantic, vagabond wanderer. They don't want to talk about the guy who was anti-Semitic, who was misogynistic. I mean, he had a great deal of anger and bad feeling toward women. He didn't take care of his own daughter. He was paranoid in many, many respects. Paranoia and feeling that there was a Jewish conspiracy in New York out to get him. A lot of it comes from his upbringing in Lowell. A lot of it comes from the way he was treated in New York. He wasn't accepted by the literary community. The people used to joke, he's the only guy, writer in New York that came out of the locker room at Columbia University. So there's reasons for it, but there is a dark side. And he was an unhappy man, a bitter man, bitter about life, feeling cheated, feeling his family had been cheated. French Canadians had been mistreated, and people had, there were, I mean, the word Canuck is really a derogatory racist term for French Canadians, and it was used all the time when he was growing up. And even when he was in New York, he's a Canuck. So there's reasons for it, and I'm not trying to excuse it, but I'm just saying, if you look into his life, there's reasons for this dark side. But so far, there's been a lot of effort to keep people from even looking at that dark side because they're afraid it will interfere with his marketability.
You think it might be there in those notebooks?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's not all that well hidden. I mean, you can find it even in some of his published writings, and certainly in the stories, biographical stories, people talked about it. And then people go too much the other way. I mean, there was a biography called by Ellis Ambern, who died, but he was gay, and he tried to make out that Kerouac was really gay. I mean, he was a flaming gay guy, and he just hit it all, and that's why he was so angry because he was hiding his homosexuality. Kerouac was bisexual. Let's go on the record. He was completely bisexual. And he had anguish about all sex because of his Catholicism. He felt all sex outside of marriage was a sin, whether he was having sex with a man or with a woman. If it wasn't marital sex, it was a sin. And he had a great deal of anguish about it. He was not gay, but Ellis Amber, I guess in an attempt to write a sensational book called Subterranean Kerouac, made out that Jack was this flaming gay man who was just keeping everything under wraps. That's going too far in the other direction, you know, and I think one of the problems when you hide everything is then you get these overreactions. Let's look at the real truth of it, you know. Let's look at the true circumstances. There was bisexuality.
Was he open about his bisexuality?
No, not at all. Yeah. His mother and his sister were devout Roman Catholics. At that time, I mean, maybe still, I'm not sure, but at that time in the Catholic Church, this was a horrible sin, homosexuality of any kind of homosexual behavior. He would deliberately leave it out of his books because he knew that his mother and his sister might read his books. He was not. When he was drunk and he was with friends, of course, he would be open about it.
Yeah. Did he drink himself to death purposefully?
Oh, yes.
Did he know he was drinking himself to death? With that the goal?
Yes, yeah, drinking? That's what I said earlier. He said, I'm taking the slow way out. He said, I can't shoot myself because I'm a Roman Catholic, and that's a mortal sin, but I'm taking the slow way out. And yes, he knew that he was very unhappy. His brother had died when he was young. He was younger than his brother. His brother died at 10 of rheumatic fever. He said, I'm going to see Gerard in heaven. I'm going to join my brother in heaven. And in fact, in one of his most famous poems in Mexico City Blues, he says, I want to be safe in heaven dead. It's an incredible line. It's like earth is so much pain. This life that we're living now is so painful. I want to be safe in heaven dead. It's sad. It's very sad. He was a sad man, a tragic man. I think that all that needs to be looked at to see where all this other stuff came from. And maybe the fact that he could celebrate joy so much, really, we would even appreciate it more if we realized the pain that it came from. We realized that despite all of the pain in his personal life, he was able to write these books that encouraged people to celebrate life and to enjoy life. It's a paradox, but maybe we would appreciate it more if we looked at the dark side and knew where this beautiful stuff came out of.
Again, you, when in writing your biography on Jack Kerouac, Memory Babe, you interviewed more than 300 people who knew him. I'm sure you interviewed many of his fellow beatniks, many, I guess, who were younger than him. Not all of them, but
Ginsberg was 4 years younger. Corso was 8 years younger. Snyder was 8 years younger.
William Burroughs might have been older.
Burroughs was older. Burroughs was 6 years older. Burroughs was born in 1914, or 8 years older. Kerouac was born in 1922.
Yeah. How did his contemporaries talk to you about Jack Kerouac?
They were initially, I think, very protective about him toward me, because there was fear that I was going to be one of the many people who've written sensationalistically about Kerouac. So they didn't want to tell me too much of his dark side. It showed their love for him. I mean, obviously, if you want to protect someone, you do it out of love. And so what I gathered eventually as I came to understand what was going on was that these people loved him so much that they wanted to protect him. They saw him as a very vulnerable soul, you know, a kind of angelic soul on earth. And there are people like that are almost too angelic for this earth, and they can't deal with the realities of life, which are really rough and tumble and dishonesty and crookedness. And there's a lot of hard things to deal with in this life. And Kerouac had a very hard time with all of that stuff. He wanted everybody to be the saintly, like his brother, the saintly 10-year-old boy who took care of the wounded squirrels, you know. And, of course, you get out into the world, and it's a different situation.
But it sounds like people who knew him liked him.
Oh, they loved him. That's why I say...
Because, again, you see all these videos of him later on in life where he comes off as...
Because he was a very non-materialistic person. He was basically, he was living for his writing and he felt he was a messenger from God to tell the truth. I mean, and he really believed this. It wasn't just some put-on or marketing caper. I mean, he really believed that, you know, he had this ability to write, and it was a God-given mission. And people sensed that about him, that there was a kind of holiness about him. And it's kind of crazy, and people say that he called Neil Cassady a saint. Well, how can you call Neil Cassady a saint? The guy's got 500 women and stole 500 cars. But Kerouac would say, yeah, but I see his his heart. I see his heart, and his heart is a saint. And in some ways, Kerouac had that saint's heart, too. And his friends all responded to that. You know, here's a person that, you know, really, and the tenderness in Kerouac, that he did feel kindness toward everyone. Lucien Carr, which was one of his early friends, said to me, when Kerouac met someone new, everyone new was someone new for Kerouac to love. Every person he met was someone new for Kerouac to love. That's an incredible type of person. You know, everyone he meets, he doesn't come in skeptical or hard-nosed. He meets you, Mitch, my God, here's a new man I can love. Here's a person I can love. Man, woman, doesn't matter. Here's a person I can love. And so it's a very rare quality. It's almost saint-like quality. And I sound like I'm writing his hagiography here, but...
he loved Neil Cassidy.
Well, he loved Neil
Cassidy
Neil
was
greatly.
Important to him.
Yeah. And how much of it, was there anything erotic in there? Maybe a little bit. I don't know.
I mean, Neil Cassidy is a character we'll get in On the Road, right?
In several of his books, Neil is the hero of On the Road. He's the hero of Visions of Cody. He appears in almost a lot of the other books. He was Kerouac's fantasy self. And in some ways, they fulfilled each other because, Neil always wanted to be a writer, but he was too much the man of action. He was out chasing women and stealing cars. He could never really sit down and except for a few rare points and write. Whereas Kerouac was always sitting there writing and had that down, but he couldn't go out and meet girls. He had to have somebody introduce him to the girls. He was so shy. He couldn't be the man of action. And so they kind of each one found the other's ideal fantasy self. It was an amazing connection. And of course, out of that connection came a lot of great literature.
Gerald Nicosia, thank you.
Thank you.
Gerald Nicosia has been our guest. He is the author of the book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century.
That does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Our intern is Jean Froger. Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can hear archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and thank you for listening.